Hello and welcome back to Surgery 101, the podcast about all things surgical, brought to you with the help of the Department of Surgery at the University of Alberta. We're available at the iTunes Music Store, at surgery101.org, and also at MedEd Portal. We've been publishing podcasts for a couple of years now, and I'm delighted to bring you our 20th episode today. We'll be hearing from paediatric surgeon Dr. Brian Dickin about the condition of pyloric stenosis. He'll be telling us why you might want to know about this condition, what the cause is, how children present with this condition, and what to look for on physical examination and biochemistry. He'll also be discussing how to make the diagnosis and reviewing medical and surgical treatment of the condition. So, let's talk about projectile vomiting here on Surgery 101. So to begin with, pyloric stenosis, this is an important entity to consider as it is a very common cause of gastric outlet obstruction. It occurs in anywhere between 1 in 300 and 1 in 500 live births. It has a propensity to involve males in about a 4 to 5 to 1 ratio over females, and classically occurs in the firstborn male. There are some pitfalls in the diagnosis of pyloric stenosis. Most importantly is the risk of profound dehydration, failure to thrive, and even death has been reported in this entity. The particular relevance to the family physician is that there is frequently a misdiagnosis, which leads to multiple formula changes, which are attributed to milk intolerance or allergies. Typically, however, the pyloric stenotic child presents as a well baby who has been feeding well up to approximately 2 weeks of age and then develops a sudden intolerance to feeding, which is inappropriately labeled as milk intolerance or milk allergy. They typically present with vomiting and lethargy. The pathophysiology of pyloric stenosis is vague, and in fact, to date, there is no definitive cause identified. However, there have been some putative factors such as seasonal variation, erythromycin exposure prenatally, prematurity, and even transpyloric feeding tubes have been suggested as etiologies. The mechanism, however, results in a hypertrophy and hyperplasia of the primary circular muscle of the pylorus and the underlying mucosa, and the resultant is a partial or complete pyloric obstruction. The clinical presentation of pyloric stenosis, as mentioned, is typically a well child that presents with non-bilious vomiting between about 2 and 8 weeks of life. It peaks between 3 and 5 weeks of life. Having said that, there are reports of newborns as early as 1 day of life that have presented with pyloric stenosis. Classically, it is a progressive, quote, wet burps, which then progresses to every feed and eventually becomes classically projectile. They may have tinges of blood or coffee ground emesis associated with esophagitis or gastritis, but the child otherwise appears normal, and they feed voraciously despite their vomiting. They may have diarrhea, which has been referred to as starvation stools, and of course this is frequently mistaken for gastroenteritis or even feeding intolerance. About 2 to 5% may present with jaundice, secondary to immaturity of the glucuronal transferase activity, as well as the dehydration associated with this condition. On physical examination, there may be signs of marked dehydration, such as a sunken fontanelle, dry mucous membranes, and more importantly, poor urine output, as evident by a decrease in the number of daily wet diapers. In addition, the child may be found to be quite lethargic, jaundiced, and a very light sign would be a decrease in skin turgor. They may have visible peristaltic waves in the upper abdomen, which is particularly marked with decompressing the stomach with an NG tube, and then allowing the child a small volume of dextrose and water, which perpetuates the peristaltic waves across the upper abdomen. And more importantly is the finding of a small palpable olive or tumor, which is classically felt at the level of the umbilicus and to the right, with firm pressure downward against the spine that the palpable pyloric can be easily palpated. 80% of children will have this finding clinically. The most important finding, however, is the presence of laboratory abnormalities, which includes a hypokalemic, hypochloremic metabolic alkalosis. The absence of alkalosis should make one very suspicious that it is not a pyloric stenosis. Some important differential diagnoses to include, however, would be gastroesophageal reflux disease, gastroenteritis, increased intracranial pressure from any cause, metabolic disorders, congenital causes such as Webb's stenosis or duplications, food allergies, and finally congenital adrenal syndrome. The treatment of pyloric stenosis. It is important to note that this is not a surgical emergency, but it is a potential medical emergency. It needs appropriate resuscitation prior to any consideration of the operating theater. This typically involves a fluid bolus of either normal saline or Ringer's lactate between 20 and 40 milliliters per kilogram, or until an appropriate urine output is achieved. An appropriate urine output in this particular instance would be that of 1 mL per kilogram per hour. An NG should be placed only if there's marked emesis, as it may perpetuate the electrolyte losses by decompressing the gastric juices. The patient should be made NPO upon suspicion of a pyloric stenosis and kept NPO until postoperatively. Labs should be measured at presentation and then at approximately 12-hour intervals until they are corrected. A corrected electrolyte profile would include a bicarbonate, which is less than or equal to 25, and a potassium, which is within the normal range. It is incredibly important to avoid all narcotics when treating pyloric stenosis, as this tends to suppress the respiratory drive and can result in death of the infant. Rarely should patients get potassium boluses. They can be simply added to the IV solutions in a dosage of 20 milliequivalents per liter, and the IV run at 1.5 times maintenance. The actual treatment itself involves a Ramstad pyloromyotomy, which is simply splitting of the outer coat of the muscle down to but not beyond the level of the mucosa. This can be done in a variety of fashions. My preference is to perform this through a superumbilical approach to minimize the postoperative scarring. Postoperatively, the pyloric stenosis patient is managed NPO for the first 6 hours, and then is initiated on a Pedialyte solution at approximately 15 milliliters given every 3 hours times 2. And then this can be increased by 15 milliliters every 3 hours, beginning with formula once the child tolerates the 15 milliliters of Pedialyte. The target should be a hydration volume of 100 milliliters per kilogram per day before discontinuing the IV and allowing the child to go home. Postoperative follow-up is routine at approximately 4 to 6 weeks. So in conclusion, we have a very brief overview of pyloric stenosis in terms of why it is an important entity, the vague, although some suggestions of the pathophysiology, the clinical presentation, and some of the differential diagnoses to consider. We've touched briefly upon the resuscitation, surgical treatment, and postoperative care of these patients.
And there we have it. A medical student's guide to pyloric stenosis in 10 minutes or less. Just before we finish, I'd like to update you on some of our plans for Surgery 101. This podcast is brought to you by the Surgery 101 team, which is myself, Jonathan, as well as Nishan, Jenny, Stella, and Tracy here at the Department of Surgery at the University of Alberta. It's this team that takes our mobile podcasting studio out to surgeons' offices, helping them to script and record podcasts, and then doing the editing and post-production that results in a final cut of our podcast that's ready for upload. And we've had an excellent response from surgeons who want to record a Surgery 101 episode. This means that we now have enough material to publish a podcast about once a week. So, starting now, as an early Christmas present, we're going to try and publish a new episode of Surgery 101 every Friday. We'll be covering a range of new topics and hearing from new speakers, including residents and medical students in surgery, as we go forward. As always, if you have comments or questions about our podcasts, please visit us at surgery101.org or email us at surgerypodcast@gmail.com. And we look forward to seeing you again next Friday on Surgery 101.